In the 1970s, our guest David Bromberg's big band was the life of the party, playing blues, country music, R&B, and some great originals, all documented on the live album How Ladle You Play Till. He was a superb accompanist and a go-to session guy when a bluesy guitar was needed. 17 years ago, Bromberg burned out and walked away from all that to learn how to make violins and later to deal in vintage American violins. For music fans, it's lucky that he got the bug again and has recorded a new album, Try Me One More Time. We'll talk about music old and new with David Bromberg after this performance of the title track of the new album.
I woke up this morning at just about 4. You know my used to be come knocking on my door. She come crying, try me one more time. She was crying, try me one more time. Oh, daddy, take me back and try me one more time. She said, daddy, I never did treat you right. I wanna rock you to sleep, baby. Every night she come crying, try me one more time. Crying, try me one more time. Oh, daddy, take me back. Won't you try me one more time? I'll give you money, daddy, I'll buy you clothes. Baby, I learned something, gonna open your nose. She come crying, try me one more time. She come crying, try me one more time. Oh, daddy, take me back, try me. Yes, I will buy you clothes. I'll give you money, too. I swear ain't nothing in the world I won't do for you. She was, try me one more time. She come, try me one more time. Well, she said, daddy, try me one more time. I said, look here, mama, it's a natural fact. You know that you quit me, I'll never take you back. And she was crying, try me one more time. Crying, try me one more time. Oh, she said, take me back, daddy, try me one more time.
David Bromberg, that's such a great way to begin that's how he began the record. Now he titled it, Try Me One More Time. It's an amazing week for me because I got a chance, yesterday I had a chance to talk with another one of my favorite people of this kind of music, and that was Ry Cooder, who kind of grew up on one coast doing what he does. And then David Bromberg, who at least was born here in Philadelphia, so we get a little bit of, we take credit for him. Now, Rye was telling me he had a eureka moment where there was a guitar, a Folkways record, and it kind of clicked for him. Did you have one of those moments?
Yeah, I did. mine was not a Folkways record. It was a Columbia record called Guide to Jazz, and it had been edited by a French jazz critic named Hugues Panisse. I guess in America you'd call him Hugh Panisse, who, of course, like all good French jazz critics, was a communist. And this is conjecture, but I'm pretty sure it's true. He, for the first track of it, to show the roots of the blues, he included a Sleepy John Estes tune called Working Man Blues. And, of course, I attribute this to his political leanings. I think he was pretty sure that this was going to be the working man's complaint. And it's very easy to interpret Sleepy John Estes any way you want because he had the diction of I don't know what. He was next to impossible to understand. But that's why they called him Sleepy John Estes, because, you know, like that. But I actually finally figured out all the lyrics, and it was actually praise. Like, there was one verse in it that went, well, the governor's built schools for the brown. I think that's very nice. The young folks use it in the daytime and the old folks at night. And I think that was serious, not sarcastic, actually. But anyhow, the intro to it, I listened to it over and over and over. And one time I was in the car. My mother was driving, so I was pretty young. I couldn't have been 16 yet. I was probably more like 14. And my mother was taking me down to the railroad station. I was going to New York for some reason. And on the way down to the railroad station, I heard, you know, in my head, his intro, and I visualized how to do it on the guitar. It's, And I knew I was right, but I didn't get to a guitar for another 10 hours.
Wow.
But it was, I mean, that was a big eureka moment for me.
But you had a guitar, though. You did.
I was playing chords and, you know, whatever I could on the guitar right at the time. But you can't visualize it on the guitar neck, how to play it, unless you play a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Now, how did you pick what you wanted to do on this album? Because this... you make a real point about this is just about capturing the songs, and you picked some really great ones. I was curious as to, these just happen to be ones you were playing at the time? Or
It has a lot to do with the guy behind the sound booth, Mark Moss. He has this great studio. It used to be in Elkton, and then it moved across the street from me. And I didn't set out to make a record. I really thought I was done with making records, but after a while I thought, well, I liked working with Mark. He was very quick and very good, and so I figured I can go in there for an hour or two, you know, and maybe in a year or so there'll be a record out of it. So on a Sunday or Monday, I'd call up Mark. If he was in the studio and didn't have anything happening, I'd go over for 2 or 3 hours, not a long time, never a long time, and I had no idea what I was going to play, except the first time I knew I was going to do some Gary Davis tunes. That was kind of the impetus. I did a show with Chris Hillman and Herb Peterson, and we were talking about how we started, and I mentioned I had been one of Gary Davis's seeing eye dogs. And they said, can you play any of that? And they said, oh, you should be doing that. And I hadn't done any of those tunes in 30 years. And I realized that I should be doing it because the reverence gone.
And it's some great songs. And I would love it if you could do the Gary Davis tune. Always.
Well, there are two of them on there.
I was thinking of Belong to the Band, but which
okay.
one?
Is the other one's Trying to Get Home, but I'll do I Belong to the Band.
Now, how did you end up being his, as you say, C&I dog?
Well, I discovered his music because he was credited on a Weavers record as the source of 12 Gates to the City. And then I found a record, double-sided record. One side was Gary Davis, and the other side was Pink Anderson, and both sides were just wonderful. And I was in Greenwich Village one evening, and I saw a sign in front of this little hole in the wall called the Dragon's Den, and the Reverend was playing there that night. And I went in and listened to him, and afterwards I asked him if I could take lessons, and he said, okay. And at first I was paying for lessons, and then he asked me if instead of paying money I would lead him.
Now, what'd you learn? Play us something that would be in his style that you would learn.
Well, I'll play you. I'll play the one you asked for.
Okay.
To that band, hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. I belong to that band, hallelujah. What kind of band you talking about? Talking about that union band? I belong to the band. Hallelujah, hallelujah, children, hallelujah, I belong, hallelujah. You can talk about me just as much as you please. I'm gonna talk about you down on my knees. I belong to the band, hallelujah. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Where I belong, hallelujah. Talk to me. Yes, well. Talk to me. If I could, I surely would stand on a rock where Moses stood, 'cause I belong to the band, hallelujah, hallelujah, children, hallelujah, yeah.
That is so great to hear, and you're right about keeping that music alive. Now, when I ask you the question about what you learned from him, stylistically, he's got that heavy heavy thumb thing going on, and his finger picking is, I mean, I'm assuming this is his style. It's really, really melodic.
The Reverend, when I first started taking lessons from him, I noticed that he only used his thumb and first finger, and I figured I could do more if I used my thumb and two fingers. But after a while, I discovered that part of the wonderful rhythmic effects he got were from only using the two fingers. Because one of the most fascinating things he would do were these rolls where he'd either go or, in other words, thumb, thumb, finger, or thumb, finger, finger, thumb, finger, finger, with one finger, and it gave it syncopation. But I learned a lot from him. I also learned to make the guitar talk and say words. And that definitely comes from the Reverend.
The preaching yeah? Guitar.
Well, you know, now that's another thing. My leading him around, I took him to a lot of churches, and he was not always the only preacher. And I heard a lot of great preachers. And when I play single string blues, I am attempting to preach, to sound like to make it sound like a sermon, with all the pauses.
You know, and that's the difference between rock and roll guitar players and blues, you know, between Buddy Guy and Stevie Ray Vaughan, who's a brilliant guitar player. I'm not, you know, trying to put him down. But the younger generation of white guitar players play continuous and it's fascinating. I don't think I could do it, but I like to play rests, because those pauses in a sermon are so important.
And also the long drawn out notes where you'll bend something, and that's definitely preaching.
Yes,
in a way of looking at. Well, you know, I was looking at your song selection in here because there's two kind of sides here, and the blues side is there's a lot of blues tunes, but. Did you come to the old timey, the country, the bluegrass side of things at the same time, or where did that come into your?
Yeah, pretty much the same time. I kind of did a round robin thing when I learned, because I wanted to play everything. So if I was hanging out with some blues players, I would show them that I was a ragtime guitar player. Mm. If I was hanging out with ragtime guitar players, I'd show them I was a bluegrass player. If I was hanging out with bluegrass players, I'd show them the little jazz licks I know. And if I was hanging out with the jazz players, I'd show them I was a blues player, you know, or something like that. And so since I could do something they couldn't do, they might show me some of what they did. And that's, I learned everything pretty much all at once.
Well, you do songs by the Johnsons. You do a Tommy Johnson tune and a Robert Johnson tune, which you point out, you do Kind-Hearted Woman on here, which you point out is a very funny song, and I had never really actually listened to the lyrics in that manner. You can do that one?
Sure. Kind-hearted woman, she'd do anything in the world for me. Yes, I got a kind-hearted woman, people. Do anything in the world for me. Yeah, but you know that these evil-hearted women, they just will not let me be. Yeah, I was out in California. There's a great big rumbling underground. Yeah, I was out in California, people. And the earth was trembling all around. You know, all them beautiful people thought it was a big earthquake coming to get them. Lord, wasn't nothing but them evil-hearted women trying to run me down. Yes, I got a kind-hearted woman, but she studies evil all the time. I got a kind-hearted woman, people, but the girls study evil all the time. You know, she tried to get David Dye to kill me, just so the man would have it on his mind. Well, now there ain't but just the one thing make me want to drink. I swear it's how you treat me. I begin to think, oh, baby,
seem the same. You know you break my heart when you call me by another man's name.
David Bromberg is our guest today, and if you were at all like me when David was coming up, you were anticipating his first album that he did for Columbia Records because you'd seen his name and you'd heard his guitar playing on a bunch of other things. I guess people primarily knew you for playing with Jerry Jeff. What led to your first recordings with Columbia? Was that through that or how did?
No. Okay, I'll tell
you. We're going way back, yeah.
Yeah, it is. I was at the Isle of Wight to accompany Rosalie Sorrells, and actually, it was to accompany Rosalie that I was at Woodstock as well. She didn't perform at Woodstock, but we were at the Isle of Wight Festival, the last Isle of Wight Festival, on a Wednesday. And, the press didn't show up till Friday or maybe Thursday. And it was the last Isle of Wight Festival because early on, 200,000 kids broke down the fences, music should be free, and marched in. And the promoters were losing their shirt and then some, but they didn't want to riot, and they put on the show. And but free audiences are, as a rule, the very hardest to play for. They are the most demanding. And this particular little group of 200,000 was really difficult. They booed several very fine performers off the stage. To my great surprise, Rosalie asked me to sing a song. She specified I should sing the Bullfrog Blues, which was a kind of a long thing that I used to do that was kind of funny, and the crowd liked it. And they permitted her to finish her set after that. And then when we came off stage, the promoters approached me and asked me if I would come back at dusk and do some more. And I said, sure. And at the time, I didn't realize that in an outdoor festival, this is the very best time to be on a stage. And I asked them, how many tunes do you want me to do? Expect them to say, well, do two, maybe three. And they said, do an hour. And I don't know that I'd ever done an hour before. but I must have hit some kind of chord with the audience as being the underdog. Because they were extremely receptive, and I got two, three, maybe more encores. Columbia Records was recording it, and Tio Macero, who was an executive there, got in touch with Clive Davis and suggested that they sign me as cheaply as possible, which they did.
And the rest.
Yeah.
The rest is history. You seem to have really... so many people from... your generation didn't figure out how to have a life, and you really did. What caused you to stop and to study violin making and go into the violin business?
I got burnt out big time. At one point, I was on the road for 2 years without being home for 2 weeks, and I was home and realizing that I wasn't practicing, I wasn't writing, and I wasn't jamming. And I thought about that and came to the conclusion that I was no longer a musician. I didn't realize burnout. I thought it would be impossible for me ever to burn out. So clearly the only alternative was it was over. I wasn't a musician anymore. I went through a huge personality crisis. My wife almost threw me out of the house. And the only thing that intellectual pursuit I found in Marin County, the land of milk and cookies, which is where I was living, was in a violin shop, violin maker shop. And so I decided to go to violin making school and start a whole different life.
Wow. And so does this feel like this is just fun time now and you're just doing this whenever you want to?
For a while, about 22 years,
yeah,
I rarely, if ever, played. And when I did, it was kind of like if you're at a picnic and somebody's got a bat and a softball, you know, and you play softball and you don't think about it again till you're at another picnic with a bat and a softball. But when I moved to Wilmington, Delaware, I had dinner before I moved in with the mayor, and he had said that there used to be music all up and down Market Street, which is the street where my store and my home is. And he said, gee, I'd love to see it there again. So I started a couple of jam sessions. On Tuesday nights, it's acoustic music kind of built around bluegrass, and Thursday nights, it's Chicago blues. And met some extraordinary musicians. And with playing regularly, I began to regain something in the order of chops, and I had learned how to sing a lot better since I stopped performing. Mm-hmm. And I was getting a visceral enjoyment out of singing, and so it's a little bit more than a softball game these days. I'm really enjoying it.
David Bromberg, his new album is called Try Me One More Time.